Well, good morning, Lakeview. Welcome here. Just one more note, if you're in junior high, grade 6 to grade 8, you can be dismissed. Youth Pastor Dallin's right here. You can follow him. He's in a checkered shirt, I think. It's called checkered flannel. Is that, what's it called, flannel? All right. If you're junior high, you can follow Dallin to the youth program there. Welcome, welcome, welcome. It is great to have you here. My name is Paul, and I'm the lead pastor here at Lakeview. Now, today, we're going to continue our series Back to the Basics. But we're also, within that series, going to be concluding Back to Community today. Over the last few weeks, we looked at what is community, why do we do community, and today we're going to look, as we conclude the community part, we're going to look through the lens of how do we do community. And to do that today, I'm going to use a parable that Jesus told. I'm going to tell a familiar story and things around it, a little bit of context. But it's a story that if you're a Bible reader, you're like, hey, I know this story. I've heard of this lots. But it's also a parable and a story that even if you're new to church, if you're new to Bible reading, if you're new to Jesus stories, you have likely still have heard this story before. And it's a story of the Good Samaritan, right? As soon as I say it, you're like, oh yeah, okay, I think I've heard of Good Samaritan. I think I know that there's something to do good to others. There's some kind of connection there immediately. In fact, in the West, we have a lot of... I'm not actually a law expert here, but there are laws made around Good Samaritan laws. So in certain places, we have Good Samaritan laws. And they often say when you're on stage, you shouldn't use like a really old analogy. And I was going to tell this story from a show I used to watch, but then Netflix kind of brings these shows back up again. And so I was going to tell you a little, it's a spoiler from a show called Seinfeld. So some of you heard it? Okay. It's like really old, 20 years old, 30 years old, whatever it is. And... it is a spoiler, so close your ears if you don't want it ruined for you. I don't know if it's too soon or not to share this. But in the Seinfeld show, the final finale of that whole popular show is the Good Samaritan Law, right? Jerry and his friends, they find themselves in this, they land somewhere, I can't remember the city, and they see somebody being robbed, and they laugh at the person. They kind of start making fun of him. And because they don't help this person, they actually get arrested and they go to jail and the show ends with them in jail. Shocker, right? So that's Good Samaritan. So that's what we're going to explore today, looking at the story and trying to ask the question, how do we do community through the lens of the Good Samaritan? So if you have your Bibles with you or if you have the Bible app, you can load it up. It's going to be, we're going to jump into Luke chapter 10, starting in verse 25. Now, there's lots of great Bible apps, and next week we're going to look at Back to Scripture, so I'm going to talk about this. If you do have a physical Bible, that's so awesome. It's great to explore it, to read it. We're going to look at that story. But there are a lot of great apps out there. The one I like is YouVersion. It's not the cleanest looking app, but it's an awesome one because there's like plans on there, and you can add friends. And I know in social media world, maybe you have plenty of social friends as it is. But what you can do in the YouVersion is that you can actually follow a plan together with a friend, with a home church. And you can have a discussion. You can read the plan. You can read the passage. You can read the writing about it and have an interaction and conversation around it. So I love YouVersion. That was a little promotional for them. So YouVersion, if you're listening, support Lakeview. All right. So Luke chapter 10, starting in verse 25. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. Teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? I'm just going to pause here for a second. Just a lot of stuff just jumps out in this first sentence at me. Some of your translations won't say teacher of the law, they'll say lawyer. And it's important to clarify what we mean by that. We're not talking about legal stuff, we're not talking about lawyers as we understand them today. We're talking about somebody who understood the law of Moses, somebody who understood Mosaic law, somebody who knew the Torah, the Old Testament, that first part of the Bible so well that they were considered an expert in the Bible. So this is a person who understands things. They're like the today's version of a theologian, right? They're the expert in spiritual matters, in religious matters. So you can kind of see right off the bat, and it does say in the text that this person is testing Jesus, but we see this test come through as he asks, like, you know, everyday question, like, what do I have to do to go to heaven? What does heaven and eternal life look like? What is that all about? You know, regular stuff that we all talk about. Just me? All right, so there's lots going on here. So he's testing Jesus. He asks this big question. And I love how Jesus replies to him. He says, what is written in the law? Like, you're the expert. What's written in there? How do you read it? And he answered, well, this is the expert. He says, okay, well, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus responds to this question with a question, which is brilliant in many ways. He basically has this religious expert who wants to put Jesus on this like testing ground to kind of show how smart he is. And Jesus turns it on him and says, well, how do you read law? How do you understand the Old Testament? And he immediately replies with Deuteronomy and Leviticus. That's where he gets that passage from, right? From two parts of the Torah, from two parts of the Old Testament. He replies with Deuteronomy and Leviticus. And what should be caught here is what he's saying to him is actually really like, if you don't have to be an expert of the law. This is something every Jewish person would know from a young age growing up in the faith. Love your God with all of who you are and love your neighbor. So the response he gives Jesus is kind of like, yeah, like we all know this. And Jesus says, well, you have answered correctly. Do this and you will live. And maybe I'm reading a little bit into the text, but the picture I get is this religious know-it-all who's going to stump Jesus and make a show of this and see how he replies and tell him, yeah, this is, yeah, you're right, that's how I think. Or, no, that's wrong, that's not how it is. And even the name teacher here, I might be reading into the text, but because he's testing Jesus, it feels like he's like, it's like a sarcastic comment. How do you understand this, teacher? And Jesus flips this all around him and has him basically reply with what should be very easily known. And so we see that this expert is really embarrassed, and we know this by the next part that he says. This is the expert of the law, but he wanted to justify himself, right? He's like, yeah, I just answered with the most simple answer I could possibly give, so now I have to justify myself. I now have to prove myself that I know who I am. He's now being stumped in front of the crowd. Somebody's watching. Somebody's taking notes of this. And so he says, but he wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, well, and who is my neighbor? Right? He's like, well, yeah, that was an easy answer, I guess. Love Jesus, love God with all of who you are, and love your neighbor. But who's really our neighbor, right? Like, let's get philosophical about this. Like, who is it really that's my neighbor? And there's this abrupt and defensive posture that you sense in the text rising from this religious leader. Who is my neighbor, he asks. And it's a good question. Now, before we answer this or see how Jesus answered this, one of the things that came to mind as I was rereading this text over and over this week and I was praying about it and thinking about this message, about this conversation we're going to have, who is my neighbor, it came to mind that our family, my immediate family, Jessica, my wife, and our two boys, we love stories. Like, we love listening to stories, to podcasts. We love Vinyl Cafe. We'll listen to these great stories that Stuart McLean tells. And we love shows and we love movies. And then during COVID, of course, we were really locked up. So we really dug into Netflix and Disney and all that kind of stuff and watched these shows. And the things we love about shows is the fact that often, even in kind of like simple shows, there's often a good guy, a bad guy, things surrounding the conversation. There's this hero quest that happens. And depending on the story, some of them are told better, some of them are told worse. Some of them are kind of flat stories, like it's very simple. There's a good guy and a bad guy, and they have to resolve this. And some give a lot more depth to the conversation. They kind of give you all the backgrounds of why the person is seen as a good guy or why the person is seen as a villain. And there's all this depth to the story. Now, hypothetically speaking, imagine you're a person that came to Canada in the 90s and you're a young person. So you missed all the 80s and all the media from the 80s. Like, this is hypothetically speaking. And you start being engaged in all the movies and shows from the 80s, even though you're in the 90s. And you're young, you're a kid, and you're in a new place. And you see this movie called Karate Kid. Now, those of you that don't know anything about it, it's a story about a boy who moves, and he gets bullied. And so there's a mentor that comes along who teaches him karate so he can defend himself. I'm going somewhere with this. And you're like, oh, this is a great story when you're a kid. But it's a pretty flat, Easy, simple story. Good guy, bad guy's a bully. Mentors come along, help this person overcome a bunch of stuff. But then, during COVID, Netflix puts out this show called Cobra Kai, which takes all the original characters from... You guys didn't think we'd be talking about this on Sunday, hey? Okay, so the Cobra Kai, they take all the original characters from the show Karate Kid and they bring them back to Cobra Kai, and now they're adults, and what they do, and it's a silly show, but they give depth to all the characters. They take the villain, Johnny, who was this bully back in Karate Kid, and they give him his whole backstory, and they tell that he's actually was traumatized and had this abusive stepdad, and he had all these things happening in his life, and that's why he was acting out, and you begin to have empathy for this flat character from the past who was just a bully. And you start going, oh, okay, that kind of makes sense. I mean, it doesn't excuse his behavior, but you begin to understand the person deeper. It's like the distance between you and this flat character way out there begins to be bridged, and you begin to understand them at a deeper level. Same with a hero, Daniel LaRusso from this Karate Kid show, who's now in Cobra Kai, and he's kind of like entitled and not a great parent, and his life like circles around karate in his 50s. It's kind of weird, but maybe if you're into karate, it's okay. We have a dojo next door. It's okay, they're good neighbors. But it's like you start like thinking, oh, this guy was a hero, but his life is actually not that clean. It's a little bit messy. There's stuff going on in him. He's not just a perfect hero. There's something wrong in this story. And so we love these kind of shows and stories that take what we would see as a flat story of good and bad and bring depth to them and have this paradigm shift, have this like switcheroo on us, have this moment where you're like, oh, there's more going on here than just good and bad. There's a lot more going on. And so we begin to bridge this distance between us and certain characters. It shows relationships. And that happens in our own communities, in our own relationships too, doesn't it? It's interesting to me because as we often in our communities and relationships, we quickly assign characteristics to people, and it depends on our intimacy with them, on the distance we have with a person, right? If somebody's really close, even if they have messy stuff, we're like, well, no, that's understandable because of this and this and this. And we have all these explanations to have empathy and sympathy and care for the person. But the further they get away from us, the easier it is to see them as a flat person. It's like, oh, that person's not really good, or that person's really is good, or this person I'm not sure about. Distance and intimacy makes a whole difference in how we perceive people, right? We have many descriptions in our communities and in our neighbors for people. We say things like, oh, that person, that is a really kind person. They'll go the extra mile for you. They will step into your life. They will love, they will care for you. Or for another person, we may say, look, that person may come off a little bit cold, but give it time. Like, they're just an introvert. Like, they have a bandwidth for people that's like so small, but once you get to know them, they're actually a really great person. And we define people and characteristics based on how much we know about them or how little we know about them, which of course makes community really hard when the world becomes very small through social media, right? Because some of the intimacy may be lost and there's maybe greater distance, but we feel like we know people. We feel like they're our neighbors. We feel like we really, really know them because we've heard things about them and it's all in our face. And we begin to make judgments, sometimes flat judgments. That's a good person, this is a bad person, this is a violent person, this is a kind person, this is an evil person, and this is a really gracious person. So we do community and we do relationships in a way that is clouded based on the distance we have from people in our lives. And our neighbors, or who is our neighbor, is based on how intimately we know people and how intimately we understand the circumstance from somebody who may be farther from us. So who is our neighbor? This is the question that the religious leader asks. And Jesus says, in reply, Jesus said, a man was going, so Jesus is just gonna like write into a story. He's just gonna, you know what? I'll answer your question with this story. I'm gonna just make up this parable. I'm gonna make the story up. So buckle up. And he says, in reply, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, they beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road. And when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So to a Levite, when he came to a place and saw him, pass by on the other side. Now it's interesting because the expert of the law replied to Jesus with a quote from Deuteronomy, the second law, the law of Moses, and Leviticus. And Jesus in his story right away addresses a priest and a Levite. It's not a coincidence. It's interesting playoff stuff. Here, you know the law, you know the Torah. Let me tell you a story about a priest and a Levite. And they're not seen in the great light. Yeah, let's keep reading. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey and brought him to an inn and took care of him. The next day, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. "Look after him," he said, "and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have." Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robber? Jesus asked. The expert in the law replied, "The one who had mercy on him." Jesus told him, "Go and do likewise." So Jesus tells this great story to help the religious leader and us wrestle with this question: who is our neighbor? How do we understand neighbors in our community, but also in the vast, small world we today live in? Who is our neighbor? Now, a good way to engage with this story and the complexities that are actually involved here is for us to see this parable maybe like a movie scene, right? Like, imagine this parable, this story that Jesus is telling is like a new show you're watching or a new movie, and, you know, it starts and there's like this new vision, and what we see in it is the road from Jerusalem to Jericho. Now, oh good, it's not, I was worried it was going to be a little pixelated, but it's not too bad. So we have this road that we are kind of unfamiliar with, but people that Jesus is talking about know exactly what this road is. It's a commonly traveled road. They know exactly what he means. They have the image in their mind immediately. And they know this is a notoriously dangerous road. So as Jesus brings this up, as their scene comes up, and we see this road, things should be firing off going, "Ooh, that doesn't look safe. That isn't good." Jerusalem is about 2,300 feet above sea level. Dead Sea, which is near Jericho, stood at about 1,300 feet below sea level. So within 20 miles of this road, there's a drop of 3,600 feet, just to give you some clarity. It's not an easy road. It was also narrow. It was about like 10 feet or so, as you could see. It's quite narrow. And the way the walls are of the hills and mountains and the way it turns and curves is that actually if you go around the corner, and it is a dangerous road, and the criminals attack you or robbers attack you, people whom a caravan behind you may not actually see you being attacked and may actually not hear you being attacked. So it's a dangerous road. This is the picture. This is the scene in this show, in this movie that's starting up for us to see is not an easy, it's not a safe road. It's like those images we have, right? Like in Saskatoon in spring, when we say Circle Drive South is closed for repairs, we know exactly what that means, right? Like it happens every spring. There's going to be orange pylons everywhere. There's going to be the zipper merge that people are still going to be learning to figure out how to do this. And it's going to be confusion. We know exactly what the scene looks like. So when Jesus says this road from Jerusalem to Jericho or from Jericho to Jerusalem, we have a picture of an unsafe road. It's not good. Now, next in the story, we have some characters. First, the traveler. Now, when I've read this story many times, the traveler, the actual person that's injured, catches our mind, but you forget about him. You focus, you know where the story's going, so you're kind of waiting for the Samaritan to show up. But the traveler is actually kind of important part of this piece of the story. I want to give you some depth and bridge some distance for you here, because the question should come up, why is this guy on the road by himself, right? Like, he's actually kind of reckless if we understand the history of this road. Because it's dangerous, and nobody going with valuables or goods would go by themselves. They would always go in a caravan, in a group of people, you know, strength in numbers. They would never travel by themselves. So the story actually unpacks for us that this guy's kind of reckless. He kind of risked this. He kind of got himself in trouble. Like, what are you doing? Like, you ought to know better. You should have better awareness where you are at. Why are you putting yourself at risk? So we have the traveler. The next character we're introduced to is the priest. Now, there's a lot of stuff going on in Jesus' stories between Jesus and the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the priests and the religious law experts. And we often put them in this like camp of the bad guys. They're the guys that are trying to get Jesus. And maybe I'm a little bit defensive here in the next part because I'm a religious person who works in a religious industry. I'm a pastor. But the priest here is probably actually a good priest. He actually knows the rules that if he touches a dead body and this guy by all, this reckless man, this traveler is, looks like by all accounts that he's gonna die, he's dying, that this priest doesn't wanna get himself unclean. Why? Well, because he has responsibilities. He has a community that he's gonna do at the temple, he's gonna perform sacrifices, he's gonna bless things, he has things to do. And putting himself in that position actually takes him away from caring for his community. Like, he likely actually has to do a bunch of things, and it's like, oh man, this guy's hurt, but like, I can't, there's people depending on me. And he's trying to be obedient to God. Now, he doesn't do the right thing, please hear me correctly, but I have some sympathy for this guy. He's trying to do the right thing, he does the wrong thing, but there's something going on in him that he's like, I can't do this, I have a bunch of duties at the temple, I gotta get to that. And then there was a Levite. And it seems like, if I'm reading into the text a little bit, that he kind of maybe came closer to the guy, but then he's like, ah, I can't risk this, because history tells us on this road, people, criminals, would often have decoys. They would pretend they're injured, they pretend they're hurt, and when you try to attend to them, their buddies would run out and get you and hurt you and maim you and take all your valuables. So the Levite is actually being shrewd. He's actually being smart. He's like, well, what if this is a decoy? What if, I'm injecting a bunch of stuff into the story, but I'm trying to give it some depth here. And he's like, no, I can't do this. So he moves on. He doesn't want to take the risk of helping someone else and risk his own life. And then in our scene, then in our story, we have Samaritan. And we kind of like, that doesn't mean much. It didn't mean much to me growing up. I'm like, oh, Samaritan. Oh, the story's called The Good Samaritan, so they must be the good guys. This is great. But that's not how the original hearers, audience, would have heard this. As soon as Jesus said the Samaritan, immediately the audience would have thought, oh, the bad guy, the villains. Because the Samaritans were, they were not in good place with the Jewish people. They were the enemy. They were the guys that were seen as villains. So they were the, as soon as Jesus mentions him, guarantee the audience would be like, oh, here comes the real villain. Yeah, sure, the priest and the Levite didn't do the right thing, but here comes the real bad guy. And we know this because even earlier in the chapter 9, verse 53, we have Jesus being rejected by the entire Samaritan village. And we read in verse 53, which says, but the people there did not welcome Jesus because he was heading to Jerusalem. And what it's telling us is the feeling was mutual. The Samaritans did not like the Jewish people, and the Jewish people did not like the Samaritans. They were each villains. They did not agree on things, both politically, but also spiritually and religiously. So, and then it's funny, part of this, just a side note, in this chapter 9, where they're like, Jesus rejected, just to show you how much Jewish people didn't like the Samaritans, the disciples, the guys that are like, the guys in Jesus' inner circle that have seen Jesus perform miracles, seen Jesus talk about, you know, turn the other cheek, love your neighbor, all that kind of stuff, love your enemies. These guys, their response to the Samaritan village is like, let's bring fire on this village. Let's kill them. Like, that's their response. Like, immediately, Jesus' inner circle is like, let's kill these guys. You can tell how much they disliked Samaritans. It was quick to say, let's kill them. So that's our context here. We see that Samaritans are not the good guys, and yet Jesus shifts the paradigm and actually says that this villain does the right thing. So he asked the religious leader, like, who did the right thing? And you see the religious leader hates him so much, he can't even say the Samaritan. He doesn't say, well, the Samaritan did the right thing. What does he say? He says, the one who had mercy on him. That's the divide and disagreement and brokenness between these people groups. He can't even utter the name Samaritan. Now, let me ask you a rhetorical question. Where do you position yourself in this story? Many of you have heard the story before. Many of you read it. Maybe you're hearing it for the first time. Where do you position yourself in this story? Samaritan, right? Typically, right? Because we know the heading says the Good Samaritan. Well, we want to be Good Samaritan. That's the guy that Jesus points out to be good. And we want to be the hero in our stories, right? In all our relationships, in all our communities, we typically see ourselves as the main character of the story, of the movie we're living in. We are the main characters. We're the good guys. After all, we can't get out of our own heads. We see reality through who we are. And so when we read the story, we're like, well, I'm the Samaritan. But Jesus is throwing an incredible curveball. He's saying the villain to the community is actually the good guy. So who is our neighbor? Well, the one who has mercy. The one that can look like a villain. And what do you do with that? How do you do community when people seem to be have more depth in them than we first presume? What do we do with people who are not in our intimate and personal spheres that we can easily call our neighbors, but people way out there, the them of our life? How are they our neighbors? Especially the them that may seem like villains. And that's not to excuse any bad stuff. I'm not, you know, with priests and the Levite, they clearly didn't do the right thing. But how do we understand people as our neighbors who we naturally pin or characterize as villains? So I'm Canadian, but I'm a Ukrainian. I was born in Ukraine. My nation is at war. Is the Samaritan in my story a Russian national? Who is that for you? Who is your neighbor? See, Jesus doesn't just tell this nice story about doing good stuff. He's shifting a paradigm. He's changing the lenses, and he's helping us bridge divides that are well-grooved and ingrained in us. If we're honest, we all have a conversation, at least in our heads, of us and them. And Jesus is changing this lens and saying, no, 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 no. That is your neighbor. That is a person who's part of your community. There's a shift that's happening here. There's a bridging of a divide. There's bringing them to us. And saying, that is your neighbor, the one who does right. What Jesus is teaching us is to resist a flat view of the story. Good, bad, villain, hero. The people are much more complex than that. In fact, as we've been saying for the last 2 weeks, they are images of God, bringing full worth of who they are into every conversation. Resist a flat view of people. And so Jesus offers a couple of things for us to grab onto, because I always like to have some things for us to kind of hold onto to understand this teaching even at a deeper level. What Jesus is doing is he's actually saying that in the Jesus community, we offer help to those in need, no matter who they are. Our imagination begins to be shaped by Jesus' view of the world, by his lens, by his imagination, so much so that we begin to risk and help anyone who's in need. You see, the Good Samaritan in the story risks his own financial security, right? Like he pays for this guy, his own reputation, because he's going to an inn where apparently he returns to Lot, so people know him. So he's saying, yeah, like I'll be back, I'll pay for this. He's caring for this traveler who's clearly reckless. Like what's he doing on the road? Like he got himself into this problem. Why should we even help him? Like he did this. I have work at the temple. We offer help to those in need. There's risk involved in our journey. And it's interesting that Jesus tells us this, because if we were to follow the story of Luke, where is Jesus heading? To Jerusalem. To do what? to risk his life for the world. There is risk involved. We help anyone who's in need. The second thing we do in the Jesus community is that we begin to see that anyone in need is actually our neighbor. That anyone in need needs to be bridged closer to us. That we ought to see community as wide and as open as Jesus does. To understand the love of God as wide and open as God does. I mean, this is what's happening in the story, is Jesus literally shifted the whole paradigm on the people listening to him about Samaritans. That even Samaritans can do good. Even them, they can do good. Anyone in need is our neighbor. And thirdly, what Jesus is unpacking for us, and that I'm seeing in this parable, is that we need to help practically, for sure. There are deeds involved in helping, but there's also a spiritual and emotional bridge that we have to bridge. I picture that no doubt that the priest and the Levite actually had some pity on this guy. But they were so locked into their religious duty and their religious standing in the community that just they couldn't break that. They couldn't see past that for the traveler who got himself in trouble. And Jesus says, your religious duties are not aligned with me when you don't help your neighbor. When you don't step outside of helping those who are in need. When you don't see whoever it is in need as your neighbor. Jesus says, go and do the same. Jesus invites us to be a community that exemplifies this Christian worldview that we often call the upside down kingdom. Those of you that grew up in the church, you've heard this term before, I'm sure, the upside down kingdom. And it's kind of like an interesting saying. If you didn't grow up in the church, you're like, upside down kingdom, what does that mean? Well, meaning we're invited to be shaped by the life and vision of Jesus, which often plays out differently than we expect, that actually plays out differently than the normal economic procedures of the world, right? Where last shall be first? How does that work? Where a master serves his servants, washes their feet? Where we're commanded to love our enemies and to pray for those who persecute us. Like, that's upside down stuff. But this is the imagination that Jesus invites us into. Invites us to offer grace and kindness to anyone in need, to anyone looking, to anyone searching. This is the Jesus community. Now, as the band comes back on stage, I want us to continue to wrestle with this idea and this imagination that Jesus is beginning to unpack for us in this story. You see, we're invited not into just a life. We're invited through Jesus into a revolutionary life. We're invited into this life that's paradigm shifting all the time and breaking down barriers and walls and inviting the unwanted into the community, who we think is unwanted. Begin to see every person as our neighbor. It's a revolutionary way to live, and there's a risk involved. To bridge those divides, there's a risk. Maybe I'll be misunderstood. What would people think if I do this? They'll actually think I'm like okay with this kind of stuff, whatever that stuff is for you. It's a revolutionary way to live. It's a way to say, if someone's in need, I'm gonna step in and bridge that gap. I'm gonna refuse to see people as a flat story of just them out there doing evil, violent things, but begin to see them as the image bearers of God, who I need to pray with, who I need to pray for, and who I need to offer support and help. And I know it's not easy, and it's not perfect, and it gets messy when we risk things. But it is as if we're designed for it. It is as if something in our souls and our spirit actually cries out for a life that's gracious and kind and loving. It's as if we were actually made for this stuff. So as we wrestle with how do we do community, I want to say two things. By refusing to see someone flatly, by demanding to see them with depth and dignity and worth, and by always risking to love someone else. So friends, as we ponder this today, let's think on the question, who is our neighbor?